This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Wesley Clark entered the race for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination last September with a most distinguished resume. First in his class at West Point, a Rhodes Scholar, he earned the Silver Star and the Purple Heart in Vietnam. White House Fellow, a key figure in the negotiations at Dayton that ended the war in Bosnia. And later, Supreme Allied Commander Europe, the man who ran NATO's war in Kosovo. Later in the program, General Clark will join us. He wants to be President of the United States. His people tell us he's running a little bit late, and he's expected to join us now in about 5 or 10 minutes. Later in the program, we'll go to Ohio, where police are looking for what appears to be a serial sniper and answering questions about why they seem so slow to start their investigation. But first, we're going to begin with the subject of General Clark, and joining us now is NPR's political editor, Ken Rudin. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Neil.
General Clark, when he joins, will be talking with us from South Carolina. General Clark joined the race late. He is bypassing Iowa, is banking everything on New Hampshire and then South Carolina, where he formally filed to become a candidate yesterday, I guess. How is that playing in those three states? Can't be popular in Iowa.
Well, no. Obviously, by getting into the race so late, certainly later than 8 or 9 other Democrats, there were 9 other opponents at the time, and then Bob Graham dropped out. But getting in the race so late means that he did not have the organization for Iowa. So my guess is that bypassing Iowa is a smart move for General Clark, who did not have the organization, did not have the money until well late, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
New Hampshire, it's a very strange thing. It seems that the battle there is for not to win, because the polls show that Howard Dean, the former Vermont governor, has a huge lead. The battle seems to be for either third place or even second place. John Kerry, the senator from Massachusetts, was presumed to have a large lead. His campaign has been dropping fast. He's been dropping fast. And the indications are that he may not finish second place. So obviously, if Wesley Clark or those who hope to be the undean, the non-Howard Dean, if he can finish in second or even a very high third in New Hampshire, according to this scenario, the momentum he'll get it going to South Carolina on February 3rd would be very strong.
And South Carolina would be presumably friendlier ideological turf.
Well, except that, you know, everybody talks about South Carolina being conservative, more military-oriented. It is, but it's also 45% to 50% of the Democratic primary electorate is African American, and that will be a key constituency that there's no indication yet how well General Clark will fare with them. But he's been campaigning this week with Charles Rangel, the Manhattan congressman in South Carolina, with Andrew Young. So obviously he's trying to pick up support among black voters.
Well, joining us now, before we get to South Carolina, let's go back to New Hampshire. Joining us now is Andy Smith, a pollster and political scientist, director of the University of New Hampshire's Survey Center. He's with us on the line from Durham, New Hampshire, and that state's primary is scheduled for January 27th. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And how is General Clark doing in New Hampshire?
Well, Clark is doing fairly well, I'd say, given that he did get started so late. He's currently in third place in our last poll. He's at 10%, but he's only trailing John Kerry, who he mentioned was in second place and had been leading here. Kerry's only at 17%, so Clark is certainly within striking distance of John Kerry.
And is he rising?
Yeah, he went up from 5% in November, so he went from 5% to 10%. And other than Howard Dean, he's really the only candidate that has had some significant movement. Joe Lieberman increased a little bit, but not that much.
Any reason that you understand as to why he's been moving?
Well, one of the things Clark has done by dropping out of the race in Iowa is that he's been able to spend more time here. And then, frankly, the way to win New Hampshire is to spend a lot of time and meet as many people as you can. It's not necessarily that you have to meet people individually, but that secondary and third level effect is very important when a person tells their friends that they met, say, General Clark and how he was as a candidate. So you just have to be up here a lot, and he has been up here a lot, and he's been advertising quite a bit. Another reason I think that he's got some upward momentum where some of the other candidates don't is that both John Kerry and Joe Lieberman, they're well known up here. These guys have been up here for months, and in Lieberman's case, in 2000, he was running up here quite a bit. So they don't have much. The voters already know these guys, and they don't have anywhere to go. They've pretty much made up their decision about Kerry and Lieberman, whereas Clark is still somewhat of the fresh face.
And Ken Rudin, who's with us here, was speculating earlier that, at least from Clark's point of view, it might not be out of the question for him to catch Senator Kerry. Do you think that's possible?
I think it is possible for him to catch Kerry for second place. the problem that Clark, Edwards, Gephardt, and to a lesser extent John Kerry have is that the New Hampshire Democratic electorate is quite liberal. It's a highly educated, high-income liberal Democratic electorate. But you still have about 40% or so of the electorate that's more blue-collar or more conservative, middle of the road. But you've got three or four candidates who are fighting for that 40%. So if you cede the top, you cede the liberal vote to Howard Dean, you're talking about fighting for that other 40%. Clark's got a pretty good chance, both because he has money, both because he's more charismatic than some of the other candidates that are running. And, he's the fresh face, and he's the guy who seems to have some momentum.
And we're now told, in fact, that we're going to be expecting General Clark at about 25 minutes past the hour. He's running a little later than he was just a few minutes ago. So we're going to be talking about, the mechanics of the campaign what expectations are. We hope to talk about the issues once General Clark joins us. But Ken Rudin, as has been noted, Howard Dean has emerged as the front runner in the campaign. Obviously, that can change if some things happen.
I would rather not use the word front runner. Certainly, he has the momentum in this race.
Well, he's ahead in the polls, let's put it that way, in the public opinion polls. But how does he compare on the issues to Howard Dean? I mean, to General Clark, rather.
Well, certainly on the war, they're the same. I mean, there's some ambivalence about how General Clark initially viewed the war. He stumbled badly when he first got into the race, saying perhaps he would have voted for the resolution, then he would have voted, and of course he would have voted against it. So they're pretty much the same on the war. I think the big difference, of course, is the national security and foreign policy credentials of General Clark. I mean, obviously, in the past week, he was at The Hague testifying at the Milosevic War Crimes Tribunal. And basically, Clark can do what no other candidate can do, and that is he stood up to a dictator, which makes him, I think, in the public eye, at least appear as a potential commander-in-chief.
And Andy Smith, as the voters there look at him, does he look like a credible candidate? Is that what's appealing, do you think, the facing up to a dictator, a man who's been in uniform, spent his career in uniform, has a Silver Star and a Purple Heart?
Well, sure. We asked about what issues are most important to people in the state. We also asked which candidate has the best plan to deal with these certain problems. And by far, Clark is seen as a candidate who's best able to deal with terrorism. So on that security issue that the Bush campaign is certainly going to be using next year, Clark is seen as a Democrat here in New Hampshire who's best able to deal with that issue.
One of the things that pollsters and political reporters look at very carefully is favorability and negative ratings. How is Wesley Clark doing there?
Actually, does pretty good. Let me pull those numbers out. His favorability rating, right now he's got 54% who have a favorable opinion of him, only 23% unfavorable, and 14% don't know about him, 9% are neutral. What I like to look at is what I call a net favorability rating, where I just take the percent favorable and subtract out the percent unfavorable. He's got a plus 31% there. Now, Howard Dean, again, very attractive to the electorate here, is at plus 61%. But John Kerry is only at plus 33, and Kerry's been dropping. He dropped from plus 48 to plus 33 in a month, whereas Clark went from plus 24 to plus 31 in a month. So Clark's going up. Kerry's going down, and frankly, if you're a candidate that's a little bit less known, those favorability ratings are incredibly important because they're an indication of the first step in convincing a voter to vote for you, and that's that they have to like you. Once they like you, then they may vote for you.
Andy, it's Ken Rudin here. You know what fascinates me about this whole Clark phenomenon, and of course we've been talking about this since September, but this guy, he's never run for office before, and nobody's done that since Eisenhower. Nobody's been elected on his first campaign since Eisenhower. But more importantly, that the week after he announced his candidacy, he led in the national polls, he got in the cover of Newsweek, and yet nobody's ever seen him campaign, nobody's ever knew much about him except for the fact that he's a fresh face. We've seen what a fresh face could do for Howard Dean, but of course there's much more to the Howard Dean phenomena than being a fresh face. How do you explain the Clark phenomena?
Well, one of the things that we see here in New Hampshire is that there's a real sense among Democratic voters up here that it doesn't really matter who gets nominated, that George Bush is going to win anyway next year, which, given that incumbents rarely lose unless they face a strong primary challenge, it's probably not an unrealistic assumption. But the sense that I've got is that the voters in New Hampshire in particular have been evaluating all of the candidates in terms of how well they'll be able to do against Bush. And outside of Dean, I don't think that any of the other candidates are expected to be able to do very well. Clark is the one candidate who's gotten into the race, who was, because he was unknown, I think it actually helped him, because he was seen as a military man, somebody with a beautiful resume. He looks good. He's telegenic. He's very he's very enthusiastic and emotional when he speaks. I think they looked at him as the white knight who was going to be able to knock off Bush. And I think that's why he came up high in the polls to begin with. He slipped down a bit, but I still think there's a sense that among Democrats that they're just looking for somebody who can beat Bush.
We're waiting for General Clark to be on the phone and speak with us about some of the issues in the campaign. We were expecting him a few minutes ago. We're now expecting him at about 25 minutes after the hour. With us in the studio is NPR's political editor Ken Rudin. With us on the line is Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire's Survey Center. And I think we have a question on the phone about the Clark campaign. Mark's with us from Durham, New Hampshire. Mark, good of you to be with us.
Hi,
you're on the air.
Okay, I have a question about Wesley Clark's record in Kosovo. I know that it was quite a military career there. But what I wonder is, I read a columnist not that long ago about him clashing with the British command, clashing with the establishment. In Washington, I believe actually he got pulled out of the command at some point. And what I want to know is how much of this is just media, how much of this is true, and is this something that we should worry about? I believe he may have even been accused by the British of wanting to attack the Russian troops.
This was after the battle in Pristina was just over, and Russian troops unexpectedly arrived at the airport there at the Kosovo capital, and there was some dust-up with, I think, Lieutenant General Michael Jackson, who was then the head of the British command troops in Kosovo at the time. And it's indeed one of the things that we wanted to talk to General Clark about. And, well, why don't we put you on hold, Mark, and when General Clark gets here, you can ask him.
Okay, excellent.
All right. We thought you had a question about the campaign itself rather than his record, so let's put you on hold, and we'll try to get back to Mark's question. As we mentioned, South Carolina comes up next after New Hampshire. As we mentioned earlier, General Clark is there campaigning hard. Lee Bandy reports on politics for the state newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina. Good of you to be with us.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you.
So far, what's been the reaction to Wesley Clark in South Carolina?
It's been a favorable reaction, and he's running strong. Most polls show him in second place. But really, this race is wide open in South Carolina. No one's getting more than 16% of the vote, and that's Dean, in the latest poll that just came out today by the American Research Group, is leading with 16% of the vote.
And so, as you suggest, then it's not like New Hampshire or Iowa. Again, General Clark is not running in Iowa, but where Dean is well ahead.
Yeah, it's For the candidates who are within the margin of error, and I would say this race is up for grabs here, and anybody could win it. People down here are just beginning to pay attention to the race. We still have about 35 to 40% of the people undecided.
What do you think would appeal to voters there about Wesley Clark?
Being in the military, and we're a very pro-military state here. Have a lot of retired military. In fact, he is reaching out to the veterans in this state. There are about 450,000 veterans here, the most per capita in the nation, in any state. And how well he's doing in that area, we don't know. John McCain reached out to the veterans here in the year 2000, but they ended up voting for Bush.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In a few minutes, we hope to be joined by General Wesley Clark, a candidate for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States. In the meantime, we're speaking with NPR's political editor, Ken Rudin, here with us in Studio 3A. Andy Smith of the New Hampshire Survey Center and the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. He's with us from Durham, New Hampshire. And also with us is Lee Bandy of the state newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina. And Lee Bandy, if you had to look at General Clark's challenge as he looked ahead to this race, what do you think it would be?
To get known, and most of the voters are not aware of what his programs are, and but that's not peculiar just to him. I think that's true with all of the candidates running. Again, as I said earlier, the people are just now beginning to focus on this race. The candidates are just now going on television, and a lot of people don't realize there's a campaign going on until the ads go up on television.
Ken Rudin?
I was just going to say, you know, even though the voters may not be paying that much attention, it is unbelievable how important South Carolina is in the scheme of things. Because if the conventional wisdom is that Howard Dean wins Iowa, he's locked in a close race with Dick Gephardt, but if he wins Iowa and he wins New Hampshire, as it looks like it's almost a foregone conclusion, then South Carolina seems to be the place where you stop Howard Dean if you do it all. Now, in the past, historically, whenever you try to stop somebody, it just shows that you don't have anything to say. You're more like they tried to stop Jimmy Carter in 76, and they couldn't. They tried to stop McGovern in 72, and they couldn't. Of course, Richard Nixon helped stop him then. But my point is that South Carolina may be the place for General Clark, John Edwards. Even Al Sharpton hopes to make a good showing in South Carolina, but that could be the beginning of the end for many candidates there.
Well, it is. South Carolina is going to be the showdown state, in my opinion. And if, let's say, if Gephardt wins Iowa and Dean wins New Hampshire, South Carolina really becomes the battleground. And my feeling is that after the South Carolina primary, there'll only be about two candidates left standing.
Andy Smith, before we get away from New Hampshire, though, voters there have been known to be a little unpredictable, a little ornery, and one of the intriguing factors in the race is that independents get to vote in New Hampshire. How are they breaking on Howard Dean and Wesley Clark?
Well, first, they're really not independents as much as they are undeclared, because I've looked at the internal leanings of those folks who are registered undeclared. It makes up about 37% of the electorate. About 45% are really Republicans. About 35 or 40% are really Democrats. And the rest might be what you call truly independents. But they're not, when you look at how they plan to vote, they're not much different than those people who are registered Democrats. Dean gets 46% overall. He gets 48% among registered Democrats. He gets 45% among those undeclared voters who plan to vote. But Clark does slightly better. Clark gets 10% overall, 8% among registered Democrats, who I should say tend to be more liberal. And Clark gets 12% among those undeclared voters, those what we'd call independents. So Clark does do a little bit better among independents.
Andy Smith, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it. Andy Smith is director of the University of New Hampshire's Survey Center. He was on the line with us from Durham, New Hampshire. And we'd like to thank Lee Bandy for his time today.
Thank you.
Lee Bandy reports on politics for the state newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina. Ken Rudin, his time is always precious to us as he joins us here in Studio 3A. Ken Rudin is NPR's political editor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Neil.
And I can say goodbye to all of them, because joining us now on the line is General Wesley Clark. And it's been a while. Let me repeat the introduction. First of all, General Clark, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Really good to be with you.
Wesley Clark was first in his class at West Point, a Rhodes Scholar. He earned the Silver Star and the Purple Heart in Vietnam, White House Fellow. Key figure in the negotiations in Dayton that ended the war in Bosnia, and later Supreme Allied Commander Europe, the man who ran NATO's war in Kosovo. Of course, he now wants to be President of the United States. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 800-989-8255, or you can email us at totn@npr.org. And, excuse me, General Clark, today is the anniversary of the bombing in Lockerbie. Last Friday, it was announced that Libya would expose its nuclear and chemical and biological weapons programs to international inspections. And if you were president of the United States, is this now the time, presuming they follow through on this, to lift sanctions on Libya and take it off the list of terrorist nations?
Well, I think we have to be very cautious about Libya, because Libya has been engaged in a lot of mischief beyond terrorism in Africa. They've been behind a lot of the troubles in Liberia and Sierra Leone. They're engaged in racketeering and corruption throughout Western Africa, and I would not want to take any immediate measures until all aspects of Libya's behavior as a state were taken care of, and then we'd need to talk about Libya itself.
In what sense?
In the sense of its human rights record and some other things. I think we just need to look very carefully at Libya. I'm happy we're moving in the right direction. I give a lot of credit on that to Prime Minister Tony Blair, and it's been patient work over 15 years. Gaddafi wants to come in out of the cold, so to speak, and he should be given the opportunity to do so, but he's got a long way to go.
Negotiations with Libya began as U.S. tanks rolled into Iraq. Is this a positive byproduct of the war in Iraq?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think that this goes back a long way, back into the trial that was held for the terrorists, back into the sanctions themselves. I think it's more an indicator that conventional diplomacy can work, that you don't solve problems by rolling tanks into countries.
Presumably rolling tanks into countries did not deter Libya, though.
Well, presumably it didn't.
In the last 10 days or so, U.S. troops have captured Saddam Hussein. We've seen that news about Libya. Iran agreed to surprise inspections of its nuclear facilities. Syria is reported to have stopped $23 million of al-Qaeda's money. James Baker went to Europe and got France and Germany and Russia to agree to reduce Iraq's debt. Some would say that's a pretty good week for the Bush Doctrine.
I think it's great, but it didn't have to wait on an invasion of Iraq. We could have gone and worked with our allies in the first place. We could have worked with Syria more closely. We could have brought NATO into the war on terror. We could have gone after Osama bin Laden. We could have had Osama bin Laden captured right now instead of having to run down $23 million he had. You know, I think the American people need to understand we were taken into Iraq under false premises. The administration made a big deal about the threat of weapons of mass destruction. Now the president says, well, it doesn't really matter. I think it matters a lot. When you ask your nation to go to war, when you've had over 400 Americans killed, when you've spent $180 billion in a country, and you say it doesn't matter. Well, I think it does matter why you go to war. And I think one of the problems we've got is an administration that's ducked its responsibilities to go directly after terrorists and instead has focused on taking us into a distraction against Saddam Hussein.
By the way, just to interrupt for a moment, General, there's a report of a earthquake in California. It's a minor earthquake. Everything we're told is nothing major to report. Obviously, we'll bring you up to date if anything does develop and details later today on NPR News. I just wanted to let people know about that. Over the past couple of days, newspaper reports have bolstered longstanding suspicions that Pakistan may have exported nuclear weapons technology. That country is run by a general who overthrew an elected government, but General Musharraf is a moderate and a key ally in the war against the Taliban and al-Qaeda. Pakistan is critical to the future of Afghanistan and also, of course, a nuclear power. Would you change policy towards Pakistan?
I think we haven't asked either Pakistan or Saudi Arabia to do enough to help win the war on terror. The money and the ideas are coming out of Saudi Arabia. The students are in Pakistan. We've got thousands of so-called madrasas there that are training young people to hate. They need to be training young people in reading and writing and arithmetic and not in hatred. And we need the determination and resolve of the world community to help us deal with this problem. Pakistan is a nation that's a problem. It is a problem in the war on terror. And yes, President Musharraf has been helpful to the United States to some extent. But more can be done. Right now, Pakistan is a sanctuary for Osama bin Laden, at least according to Newsweek magazine. And I'll bet if Osama bin Laden can be found by Newsweek, I bet he could be found by the United States, Pakistani authorities, if we had the will to do so.
Email question from Miriam Velez in Cooper City, Florida. General Clark, I'd appreciate your opinion about nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. Who should or should not have them, and why?
Well, I believe in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and so we're asking all countries to sign up and not to develop nuclear weapons. Chemical and biological weapons, there's a organization there that's designed to, it's called the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons. We've got more than 100 nations who've signed that treaty to prohibit those weapons. Still, some of our friends have chemical weapons, and we should be encouraging them to give up those weapons. As far as biological weapons are concerned, the United States has not moved ahead with the convention it was going to sign with first the former Soviet Union, or the Soviet Union and Russia, on the Biological Weapons Treaty. We need to move ahead, and we need to use international law first to convince nations that they're not safer with these weapons, that these weapons do not add to their security. And then we need an effort to go in and help resolve the problems that nations fear that lead them to generate weapons programs, to acquire weapons like this.
Would that include Israel?
Israel is a sovereign state. It's in jeopardy in the Middle East. And as President of the United States, I'm going to be very strongly committed to the survival of the state of Israel. And I'm also going to put someone on the ground who's able to negotiate and lead negotiations between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And we're going to work it in accordance with the roadmap.
And that
I
doesn't.
Think that's the key first step before you get to any other matters. It's a matter of American leadership to help bring that quarrel and that fighting over there and that killing to a halt.
So you would not address Israel's possession of chemical weapons and 200 or 300 nuclear weapons?
Well, I don't know whether they've got chemical weapons or not. I've heard the stories on the nuclear weapons, but what I know is that it's not those weapons that are causing the problem in the Middle East. We can address those weapons most effectively by having U.S. leadership to resolve the clash between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
Our number is 800-989-8255, and let's go to the phones. And Jay's with us from Fort Madison, Iowa.
Hey, it's a big honor, and I want to tell you, I hope that you're doing well with your health and your inspiration, because you sure have inspired me and other people. When I read you in Rolling Stone, and I also saw your town hall meetings on C-SPAN, I thought it was great the way you just directly answered the people, and you really tried to find a straight answer to give them.
Thanks a lot, Jay.
Yeah. What I wanted to ask you was, I want to ask how you differ with Howard Dean. I don't really think he's going to be a good thing for our party. And the reason is, I think that you can go to the middle and southern states. I feel like you could talk about you and John Edwards, you talk about values and faith. You talk about being strong with the military, which, you know, when you go against Bush, you're not going to have no questions about that and how security goes. And just the real, you know, the middle and southern values that we have. And I want to see how you differ with Dean on those.
Well, I don't know any of Dean's positions. I don't study his positions. I just look at my own positions. And what I believe is a strong American military, but the use of force is a last resort. I believe that we need to work with international organizations, including the UN and North Atlantic Treaty Organization. I believe we've got to include and work with other nations, not just threaten them. At home, I believe that we've got to put our resources into creating jobs in America. We've got to stop rewarding companies that are exporting jobs from America. We've got to provide health care for our children. We've got to follow through on our responsibilities to veterans and our seniors. We've got to really enforce environmental regulations. And most of all, we've got to protect the liberties, the Constitution of the United States. Patriotism in this time is to stand up and speak out. And that's part of democracy. That's what patriotism is in America. And when I'm president, we're going to protect that. I believe in faith. I believe in personal liberties. And I will protect the American flag. I think those are values that sell across this country. But they're the values that I've lived, and they're the values that I believe in. And, you know, if you're going to ask me the difference between other candidates, I can't really tell you that. But I'll tell you this. I'm not a politician. I've never changed my views to run for office or to try to be elected. I've never stood for elective office before, so the views you're hearing from me are my views. They're what I believed in and lived, not something I shaped to climb up a political ladder.
Jay, thanks very much for the call.
Yeah.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And General Clark, let's go to Mark, and Mark's with us from Durham, New Hampshire.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Hello, General Wesley Clark.
Hello, Mark.
Maybe a slightly critical question, but I would like to ask you about your record in Kosovo. It was reported at the time in The Economist magazine that you disagreed with the British commanders there, and they even went as far as accusing you of trying to start World War III by attacking Russian troops. There was also some disagreement with Washington, and I would like to, if you could please, perhaps comment on this and maybe set the record straight for us.
Well, it's all laid out in writing in my book, Waging Modern War, and it's available on the Internet. And I would encourage you to go to the book and read it. It's a long and complicated story. But the nuts and bolts of it are this. I believe that the United States has to take a strong stand against ethnic cleansing and against genocide. And we did that in the Balkans. We did it over the objections of some of my colleagues in the Pentagon, and we did it over the fears of some of my colleagues in uniform in other countries. We were successful. We saved 1.5 million Albanians from being ethnically cleansed out of their own country, and I'm very proud I did it. As far as the details are concerned, look, anytime you're in war, people are going to disagree. And I think the real question is, did I make the right judgment? And I think the results speak for themselves.
Let me just follow up on that for a second, General. Did you misjudge Slobodan Milosevic at the start of the war? It's been widely reported that your advice was that he would back down if faced with the threat of bombing?
I never said he'd back down.
And that the war would last only 3 days if bombing began?
I never said 3 or 4 days of bombing, ever. I tell you what I did say. I did say there was no way of knowing how soon he would back down. And what I encouraged NATO to do was prepare for a campaign of indefinite duration. That's the campaign I led. There was never a misjudgment about Slobodan Milosevic, sir.
The campaign was not ready for indefinite duration when it started.
Yeah, but the reason it wasn't ready wasn't because of the military. It's because NATO and the United States politically were not ready to face up to a campaign of indefinite duration. What I did was steer the United States military and the NATO military so that we could live within the political concerns and still have a successful campaign. I walked the line between trying to lay out a campaign that would end up with the invasion of Belgrade and doing nothing. And that's the campaign that succeeded. It was a really tough campaign because you had political constraints, you had military concerns, and you had to be able to make it work. We did it. We did it with losing only 2 aircraft and not a single pilot, and we succeeded. And that's the real standard to measure it by.
Mark, thanks very much
for the call.
Our guest is retired General Wesley Clark. He hopes to be the Democratic nominee for President of the United States. And let's take another phone call. Our next caller is Robin, and she's with us from Berkeley, California.
Hello, Neil. Hi, General Clark.
Hi, Robin.
Hi. Your military credentials and qualifications to be a commander-in-chief are amazing, but I'm interested in hearing some of your views on domestic policies, and in specific, here in Berkeley in Northern California, our teachers and public schools have been devastated by budget cuts and the No Child Left Behind Act. Can you speak about how you feel about the No Child Left Behind Act and how you might turn the situation around?
Well, thanks. I sure will. I'm not in favor of the No Child Left Behind Act. I am in favor of public education, but the No Child Left Behind Act is a Trojan horse bill that basically undercuts public education. It's already starting to do so, as students across the nation are being told that that they can't be tested in any other programs than math and English, and other testing's being dropped. Special education students are losing some of their assistance because states are running out of funds to be able to meet the legislated requirements of No Child Left Behind. Skilled professionals are being discharged from our public schools. The No Child Left Behind Act is basically designed to undercut public education. Here's what I'll do. Number one, I'll put the resources into funding that are required. The No Child Left Behind Act is about $8 billion short. Number two, we'll change the standards. We ought to be measuring how much students learn, not trying to get every student to pass a single test. We need more sophisticated evaluation standards. They need to be developed inside states, inside communities. They need to take account of what teachers can actually do. And we'll change the anti-public education stance of the No Child Left Behind Act to something that's pro-public education. If people need resources to get their qualifications up, we'll provide those resources. If teachers need coaching and assistance, we'll provide that assistance. We're not going to undercut public education under my administration. We're going to improve it.
Robin, thank you.
Thank you.
And now let's go with Scott. Scott's with us from Mannheim, Germany.
Yes, sir.
You're on the air, Scott.
General Clark, sir, I was going to ask you about your thoughts on the military. Do you think that we're kind of spread too thin with the number of troops that we have stationed permanently in places like Europe and Korea? Do you think the number of troops stationed outside the United States should be reduced and maybe have the troops brought back inland and be prepared for rapid deployments as the need may arise?
Well, Scott, I sure appreciate your question. I hope everything's going well over there in Mannheim.
Yes, sir.
I'm really worried about the military. We are overextended, but the primary cause of that is the mission in Iraq. And we've used our troops overseas to good purposes for 2 generations to help promote U.S. diplomacy, to strengthen our allies, and to be able to serve as a quick reaction force to unforeseen challenges abroad. So I'm not especially eager to bring troops back home. I am eager to reduce the size of the commitment in Iraq. We want to have a success strategy that lets us draw down those forces there and lets us focus on Al-Qaeda instead of on Iraq. Depending on how long we stay there, we may have to increase the size of the U.S. Armed Forces. I'm really worried about the guardsmen and the reservists. I talked to their families here. I talked to a lot of the troops. They didn't sign up to be committed for 18 months, and apart from their families for that period of time. So I think we got some real challenges with the size of the force and the commitment the president's launched us into in Iraq. So as commander-in-chief, I'm going to do everything I can to make a success of Iraq, get us out of there as rapidly as possible, and return us to a more normal posture. And then in the course of that, we'll take a look at the size of the commitments in Europe and the Far East.
Scott, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Scott.
General Clark, you criticized the president's policies on the economy. There was a recession. A lot of people lost their jobs. But now the economic indicators are up. Employment is picking up. The Dow Jones average back over 10,000. Do you give the president any credit?
Well, I think that we've missed some big opportunities on the economy. The tax cut that was put in was a tax cut that was designed for a different purpose. It was designed to give money back to wealthy taxpayers. It didn't give much back to middle class and ordinary people. And as a result, it was a pretty inefficient tax cut in terms of raising demand. Had we had the right kind of fiscal stimulus, we might have seen a real economic recovery a year ago. In addition, I can't give the president much credit for what he's doing on jobs because not much is happening on jobs. We've lost employment in manufacturing for 40 months consecutively. And even this last month when we picked up 57,000 jobs, if this country doesn't create 130,000 jobs a month, it's not even meeting the average of new labor market entry. So we're just falling behind. I don't pay a lot of attention to economic statistics. There's a whole industry out there designed to make you feel good about the economy. But what I look at is people's faces. I'm traveling across America on this campaign, and I keep meeting people who can't find work. We've got 8.8 million Americans unemployed that we know of. We've got 2 million long-term unemployed. These are people who would like to work. Some of them are very highly skilled engineers, software engineers. Some of them are people who are in all walks of life, salesmen, executives. They've been cut, and many of these jobs are not coming back. It's not enough just to give tax cuts to the wealthy. That's not an economic program. We've got to have specific programs designed to rebuild American science and technology, to rebuild American manufacturing and industry, to stop rewarding companies that send jobs abroad, to buy American for the essential things we need for our country, hardware and software. We've got to face up to the risks as well as the opportunities of the global environment. The Bush administration has not done that.
Let's get one last caller in, and this is Elizabeth, who's with us from Ipswich, Massachusetts.
Yes, General Clark?
Yes.
I am from a long line of military. My grandfather's an admiral. My father's a captain. I have two brothers who are lieutenants, also pilots. My question is, from that point of view, I understand what it takes to be successful in the military, and your record is amazing. And the fact that you graduated first in your class, you speak multiple languages, I would think that all of these things are very important in a leader, you know, somebody who's intelligent, who understands what hard work is. Why do you think there is a dumbing down of the United States that everyone seems to want to appeal to the common man, whereas I feel the common man, quite frankly, scares me because I don't think that the common man is that bright. So why do you think it is that even though you don't have a political record, why don't people concentrate on what you have done, and why are they so unaware of your accomplishments, and why doesn't that count?
Well, Susan, I thank you for your compliments, and you know, this is politics, and when you get into a race and you got nine other people in the race, I mean, it's they take shots, and that's what it's about. But I do think it's very important that we pay attention to ordinary Americans. I don't know if that's dumbing down or just simply the way our country is. People are caught up in their ordinary, in their daily lives. I mean, they don't have time to do all the study, and they get their news from lots of different sources, and it takes time to get a message out, to have people get to know you. That's why I'm working hard up in New Hampshire. I'm up there most of the time. I'm down in South Carolina today. I'm meeting people. I'm letting them get to know me. And I think it's proving to be very effective. I think I'm getting tremendous traction up there. But one thing about politics is you got to trust the voters, and I do. People don't always know a lot, but they know enough. And election campaigns have a way of bringing out the truth. They have a way of normally bringing out people's characters and so forth. And I'm standing in this campaign because I'm confident that I will ring true to the American people and will get a lot of support in it. I'm proud of what I've done, but I want to communicate with ordinary people.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for the call.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
Wonderful job.
And General Clark, we know we've kept you longer than we promised, and we wanted to thank you. And by the way, happy birthday tomorrow.
Thank you very much. It's been great to be with you.
It was very nice of you to join us and keep the commitment to stay with us.
Thank you so much.
General Wesley Clark, candidate for President of the United States, on the phone with us from California. On January 6th, NPR is hosting a Democratic candidates debate. We'll be in Des Moines, Iowa that Tuesday, surrounded by the men and one woman who want to challenge George W. Bush for the White House in 2004. If you'd like to submit a specific question for one of the candidates, again, a specific question for a specific candidate, you can email it to us at election@npr.org. Remember, one question for one candidate. If you would, please give us your full name and where you live, and tune in on January 6th. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.